Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, it's the Tom Hartman Podcast, brought to you by Cameron Hughes Wine. There's a little secret that most people don't know about the highest quality wineries in the United States and how they work. They'll say, you know, as they start their year, okay, we're going to bottle, say, 5,000 bottles of wine this year. And so they overproduce for that, produce enough for maybe 6,000 bottles of wine. But, you know, they've sold 5,000, they're ready to get 5,000 out. And so that's basically all they do under their own label. And then when they're done, they've got casks of wine left over that haven't been bottled. Cameron Hughes contracts with some of the very best vineyards in America to take that essentially surplus wine. I mean, you know, it's the exact same wine you would buy in a bottle for 50, 60, 100. One of the Cameron Hughes wines I had last week, the retail price, if you knew who the brand was over $150 a bottle. Cameron Hughes buys that in bulk, bottles it, puts just a simple number. Here it is, lot 506 or lot 622, simple number on it. And you get some of the most spectacular wines at huge discounts off what you would normally pay. Cameron Hughes has been doing this since 2001, seeking out high-end wine from around the world and selling it online direct to his customers. This is not just American wines, earning Cameron Hughes Wine the number one wine brand online. It's just extraordinary stuff. I recently sampled Lot 609. This is a Cabernet Sauvignon. It was insane. It was so good. It was bold. It was rich. It had the black fruit and red licorice and crushed red rock, all these extraordinary tastes, juicy and ripe on the palate. You got to check this out. Go to chwine.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. C-H as in Cameron Hughes, that's his name, the guy who started the company and runs it. I've talked with him. He's a great guy, and he's doing amazing stuff. chwine.com/THOM, or text the word wine, W-I-N-E, text the word wine to 511-511, and you'll get free shipping with your minimum 3-bottle order. So text wine to 511-511. Cameron Hughes Wine, exceptional value, extraordinary wine. Now enjoy the podcast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon, and available in various places all over planet Earth. So glad to have you with us. So an interesting event here, this what happened in Singapore, the meeting between Chairman Kim and Donald Trump. And it raises a question that I don't know the answer to. And I thought maybe we could kind of crowdsource an answer to this question. I think that we all agree, Democrat, Republican, whatever, that if reaching out to Kim and beginning a dialogue leads to a reduction of Kim's violence against his own people, an increase in the quality and standard of life in North Korea that is not accompanied by an increasing repression. Keep in mind, the United Nations 4 years ago said that the level of violence against human beings in North Korea, the level of, of propaganda being used against human beings, against people, citizens in North Korea, is only analogous, it's only similar to that seen by the Nazis in Germany in the 1930s and the early 1940s. That's how bad North Korea is. But I think that we can all agree that if this, you know, outreach makes things better in some way for the North Koreans and for, you know, the anxieties of the South Koreans and for the region in, as a whole, and ultimately for the United States, since Kim now has nukes and has delivery vehicles, missiles that can reach Chicago or even Washington, D.C., probably good for us, too. But that said, and by the way, this was what Barack Obama campaigned in the primary in 2007 on, that he was willing to reach out to Kim. And he was absolutely trashed for that by all of the Republicans, as well as a number of Democrats, including Hillary Clinton. But Obama had said he'd be willing to reach out to Kim. Trump reached out to Kim. You know, at a certain level, you know, if that produces something good, I'm willing to give him credit for that. But there's something that has me completely baffled that I'm turning to you for thoughts on in this first hour of our program today. We know that and that's the military exercises off the coast of Korea, of the two Koreas. These have been going on since the 1950s. You will recall in 1947 or 48, Harry Truman's administration, at the advice of Secretary of State Dean Acheson, withdrew U.S. troops following World War II, withdrew U.S. troops from South Korea. Kim's grandfather immediately invaded South Korea. And so we've had troops there ever since. And pretty much ever since, well, you know, that started the Korean War, which Dwight Eisenhower ran as a Republican in 1952 on a campaign of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. You've heard me play that clip here on this program for years. So Eisenhower ran as the peacenik, as the George McGovern of his day, and he won, and he ended the Korean War, or he at least signed a truce. I'm not even sure it's a truce. I'm not sure it's an official armistice, but whatever it is, we paused the Korean War. And that's what Eisenhower was elected to do. And ever since then, you know, starting a couple of years after that, Eisenhower organized these military exercises with the government of South Korea that really picked up steam in the 60s after Park took over in 1965, the military coup that led to the modernization of South Korea. And these military exercises, Trump just gave it away. He just gave it away. Now, we don't know if he was just talking. I mean, so far, the U.S. military is saying, hey, as far as we know, we're still doing the exercises. We don't necessarily listen to Trump, apparently. But the North Korea, the newspapers, giant headlines. Military exercises over. Chairman Kim does brilliant negotiation. Puts his thumb on Trump. Stops Trump and his awful exercises. No more intimidation. Chairman Kim backed Donald Trump down. Chairman Kim cowered Donald Trump. Trump hiding in the corner because Chairman Kim got what he wanted. Number one, no more exercises in the Gulf or on the sea off the coast of North and South Korea. And these were huge military exercises. I mean, 20,000 Korean troops, 20,000 American troops, battleships, aircraft carriers, destroyers, bombers. I mean, this was huge stuff. So the North Koreans are saying, number one, we got rid of that. And number two, every time we do something in the direction of denuclearization, the U.S. is going to reduce their sanctions against us. It's what's called phased reductions. Neither of those, which means that because Kim is saying, hey, he's already blown up, you know, his nuclear missile testing site that was already falling apart. He blew it up. And so now, hey, reduce some of those sanctions. So that's the second thing that is in the North Korean papers. And by the way, the Chinese and Russian papers saying, yeah, Kim got two major victories from Trump. What did Trump get from Kim? Absolutely nothing. According to according to everybody, right? Absolutely nothing. And this agreement, I've got the agreement sitting here in front of me. We commit to establish new relations. We will join in our efforts to build a lasting and stable peace. You know, we reaffirm the Panjimon Declaration of April 28. You know, it's nothing. They're gonna find some old remains of our soldiers from the Korean War, and for several million dollars apiece, they'll ship them back to us. That's it. That's what Trump got. Now, we know that North Korea wanted us to stop the military exercises. They killed almost 40 Americans a few years back when they fired a missile, a submarine fired a missile into a U.S. ship and sank it. They killed a bunch of Americans in protest of these exercises. China has been protesting these exercises forever. Russia has been protesting these exercises forever. China and Russia, of course, being two of the three countries, South Korea the third, that actually have borders with North Korea. So Putin wanted the exercises to end. Trump says we'll end the exercises. Chairman Xi of China wanted the exercises to end. Trump says, cool, we'll end the exercises. Chairman Kim of North Korea wanted the exercises to end. Trump says, cool, we'll end the exercises. All three of them also wanted phased reductions. In other words, every time Kim does any little thing, we reduce the sanctions. Whereas the position that the United States has always taken is once North Korea's denuclearization reaches the point where it cannot be reversed, we will start rapidly lifting sanctions. But until then, it's all just talk. And we've heard this talk for 70 years, 60 years, however long it's been. We've been hearing this talk for years and years. I guess it's been 60 some odd years. So the question, why did Trump give this away? Why did Trump do what Korea, North Korea, China, and Russia wanted? And by the way, at the time, South Korea is trying not to embarrass Donald Trump, but they haven't come out and explicitly endorsed what Trump said. They've made a vague statement that said, oh, yeah, anything that works toward peace is a good thing. In other words, you know, we're not going to embarrass Donald Trump. But what American intelligence wanted, what the American military wanted, what American politicians wanted of both parties, what I believe the American people wanted, which is actually dismantle your nukes and, you know, come into the world and let some of those hundreds of thousands of people in your gulags, I mean, these violent prison camps for people who merely had the temerity to have a little tiny portable radio so that they could listen to South Korean news and find out what's going on in the world. You do that, you're in prison for the rest of your life in North Korea, if not executed, just for having a damn radio. I mean, at the very least, Trump could have said, okay, we'll give you all this stuff if you'll just, like, make it legal for North Koreans to have radios. No. So why did Trump do what Xi of China wanted, what Putin of Russia wanted, what Kim of North Korea wanted, but not what is in America's best interest? Why did he do that? What did he get out of this? What does Donald Trump get out of this? Is it that he wants to build a hotel on the beach in North Korea? He made a reference to that in the speech. Is it that you know, he owes something to the Russians big time? I think it's enormous amounts of money that he's borrowed. Others think it's, you know, Putin's got a PP tape on him. God only knows. Is it that he owes something to them and he did it to help Putin? Is it that he owes something to the Chinese? They just invested $1 billion in his hotel in Indonesia.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What is it? What did Trump trade away when he betrayed the United States this week? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. This hour brought to you by the electric toothbrush Quip. Get Quip, GETQUIP.com/Tom/THOM. Okay, so one of the things that I mentioned yesterday, and actually Senator Jeff Merkley brought this up, and I had been planning on doing a whole rant about it, but he brought it up and we talked about it, and that kind of became my rant, was Trump's self-interest right? Trump's comfort levels. Trump is very uncomfortable with Democratic and Republican, and I use those words in the classic sense of the word. You know, back in the day, these days, typically we refer to governments that are ruled by their people rather than their autocrats or their oligarchs as democracies, and we refer to those people as small d Democrats. But in the 1700s, they referred to them as small r Republicans, which is why Thomas Jefferson was always talking about a Republican form of government. In other words, we want a republic. We have both a republic and a democracy. We are a democratic republic. So you can use either word. But Trump finds himself mostly uncomfortable around Democratic, Republican leaders, heads of state who actually are accountable to their people. People like Justin Trudeau, people like Emmanuel Macron, people like Theresa May. He finds himself very uncomfortable around these people because he's an autocrat. He's always been the king of his own company. He's always been the leader, you know, the ruler of his own world. He was born with millions of dollars. His father, you know, when he wanted to go into business after he got out of college, which his father got him through, when he got out of college, his father said, "Here's $1 million. Start your own business, Donald." And then ultimately gave him several $100 million, which had he invested it, he'd be worth far more than $10 billion right now had he simply put it in the stock market. Instead, he blew it over and over and over again, and right now his last report was that he was worth a little over $1 billion. I don't even think he's worth anything. I think he's totally negative, in debt. But in any case, my point is that he feels comfortable around people like himself who have absolute control, which I think he thinks he has in the White House. I mean, the pardon power is like the one area where he's like, "Hey, I can do anything I want, right?" He feels comfortable around these people. People like Viktor Orban of Hungary, people like Erdogan of Turkey, people like Putin of Russia, people like Xi of China, people like Duterte in the Philippines. Many of these countries are, you know, theoretically democracies, but they have strongman leaders who basically don't brook much dissent and who use nationalist themes to maintain themselves in power over long periods of time, which is what Trump would like to do. So he feels much more comfortable with guys who can basically snap their fingers and make things happen, like he could when he was in business, as opposed to guys who have to go and pitch it to their people, and then their people vote for their elected representatives, and then the elected representatives get together and say, you know, here's what's going on. But I want to add one more thing to the equation before we hit the break, and then I'll pick up your calls. I see all our lines are full right now. I'll pick up your calls as soon as we come back from the break. I want to add one more thing to why he might feel comfortable with these people. We now know from the Mueller investigation that 2 months before the election, Donald Trump was negotiating with Russia to build a Trump Tower in Russia. Ivanka, in fact, you know, the Democrats in the House on the Senate Intelligence Committee want to interview her. She was apparently part of these negotiations, this weightlifter and all this kind of stuff. We know that Trump wants to build properties while he's building his stuff in China. He wants to do something in China. He's got an operation in the Philippines. He's got hotels in some of the most repressive governments around the world. The Chinese just gave him $1 billion for his hotel in Indonesia. Just a month ago. Right? And then he said, "Oh, fine, you know, sell your spy phones in the United States, no problem." So a second possibility I want to present to you, and then I'll pick up your calls, is that he doesn't just like these folks because temperamentally he's like them. He likes them because it's easier to do business in corrupt countries. All you have to do is pay off the leadership, and you don't have to worry about building codes or anything else.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
You don't have to worry about what the citizens want. You don't have to worry about what the neighborhood wants. All you do is just pay off the autocrat. And now he wants to build a hotel in North Korea. Is that it?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me, I'm really pleased to have Amy Siskin. Am I saying it right?
Siskin, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We did this before. Former Wall Street executive, currently the president and co-founder of The New Agenda, compiler of The Weekly List, which is now being archived by the Library of Congress. How cool is that?
At least it's safe.
Yeah.
Until they take that over, but it's safe.
I have one book, it's called Think Fast, that's in the Library of Congress. It won an award with all this weird stuff, but that's a big deal, the Library of Congress archive. And the list is this, the subtitle, A Week-by-Week Reckoning of Trump's First Year. And theweeklylist.org is your website. And is there a Twitter handle?
Amy_Siskind. Not just for me, not for the Weekly List. But the Weekly List does have a Facebook page.
Okay. And also for our listeners and viewers in Portland, Oregon, she's doing gigs today at Bethany's Table at 1 o'clock and at Alberta Rose Theater tonight. And they're both sold out. But you will be doing book signings for people who couldn't get tickets in both those places right after the events.
Right.
And people can find that information, presumably, at theweeklylist.org?
Yes.
Okay,
there
great.
There you go. Thank you.
So let's get into it. Amy, we talked before about, you know, keeping this list of all the just insane stuff that insane is the wrong word. How unnormal, if that's a word, this administration is from the past, and how, you know, the big danger was normalizing this administration. Where are we at now?
We're pretty much there. I mean, our government is basically now the Trump organization, Trump unilaterally making decisions and surrounded by sycophants. And anybody that opposes him or doesn't want to, you know, go along with what he's doing is shown the door or resigns.
Like Mark Sanford yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and a lawyer at the Department of Justice who wouldn't carry out what Sessions wanted to go after the ACA, which is really not normal. So basically, our executive branch is shrinking. Our White House staff is shrinking. And as long as the Republican Party doesn't stand up to him, basically, you have one person making all the major decisions in our country. And examples like Mitch McConnell refusing to put Bob Corker, Republicans, bipartisan bill to stop Trump on tariffs, or at least to hold him in check, refusing to bring that to the floor. And of all the ironies, the Koch Industries and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was along with Corker. That's where we are. You know, Corker and Ryan are protecting him now.
Couldn't you argue that Mitch McConnell withholding the constitutional right of President Obama to nominate Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court was somewhat the beginning? And of course, you got Draper's book, When the Tea Party Came to Town, where he, for the first time, outed this meeting, the secret meeting that was held at the Caucus Room restaurant on January 20th, 2009, mm-hmm. where they plotted to bring down the Obama presidency, that maybe even it started there.
So many of the things in this book are things that he's undoing that Obama did. And interesting that you speak of his picks for judges. He has taken us back to Reagan levels in lack of diversity, 24 years. Mm. There was just a study that's going to be in my weekly list this week in week 83, that 88% of his picks, Trump's picks, are white and 76% are male. And to put that into perspective, Obama's picks during his 8 years were 36% white male. So we are going so far backwards. The nature of who he's filling these slots with, extremists, people that aren't qualified at all, that had blogs, that are not, you know, were not given the okay by the American Bar Association. But so much of what he's doing is taking apart, dismantling Obama's legacy, and then as well just doing things that benefit him. You really have to look in the prism of our foreign policy now is basically what helps Trump and his family members, what enriches them. It's literally happening.
For example,
with Kushner suddenly getting money from South Korea in last week's list for one of his properties in New Jersey, that they had a beef with Qatar because they wouldn't refinance 666 Fifth Avenue, and now suddenly things have changed because they see that our foreign policy is dictated by that. Potentially in North Korea, I mean, you can't make this stuff up, that Trump was talking to Kim Jong-un about what fabulous properties they could build in North Korea. Like, I mean, this is right in our face. And then countries that have traditionally been our allies. And this started early when I started keeping track, when Trump said he wasn't sure we were going to be part of NATO. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a video that I did with Move On that's on the Weekly List website that speaks about this, that from the time he's taken office, he's alienated us from our allies and moved us towards authoritarians, starting with Duterte, Erdogan, Kim Jong-un. You know, these are unthinkable things. Yeah. And who does this New World Order benefit? It benefits Putin, because if there's not a strong force to fight against what he's doing in Europe or globally, then he becomes more empowered.
Well, even beyond that, I think that, you know, Putin is the face of oligarchy. I mean, it seems as are all of these guys, by and large, oligarchy.
Yes.
and authoritarian governance, and it's increasingly looking to me like the New World Order is a purely oligarchic one. I mean, Jimmy Carter on this program a couple of years ago said, we no longer have a functioning democracy. We are now officially an oligarchy.
Yes.
And then the question is, when do we slide from oligarchy to autocracy, you know, to absolute strongman rule? And I think most Americans, we're not even having that conversation. And it looks to me like we're seeing that happen right in front of us.
We're there. I mean, we're having midterms in 5 months. Typically, we would be speaking about policy. Republicans and Democrats would be talking about policy. You don't see any of those kind of things happening. The Republican Party doesn't have a policy platform. Basically, Trump is dictating what the Republican Party and what our government does. There's nothing that puts him in check and balance. So effectively, we are an authoritarian regime. I mean, if you stop and think about it, and unless our media learns to cover him differently, I think uniquely Reuters, who said early on they were going to cover him as an authoritarian, and then, you know, people like yourself and talk shows that are doing it. But so much of, like, look how he played our media this week. It's just, you know, it's sickening, the stagecraft, how they gave him this normalization, this legitimization. It's like gaslighting the American people.
But at the same time, last week we learned that, starting some months ago, that he's also using the FBI to spy on reporters.
Yes.
who are talking to sources inside the government, something that historically was considered noble, right? I mean, you know, Woodward and Bernstein won a Pulitzer Prize for this and took down Nixon. And if they had been talking to Mark Felt today, and the FBI found out about it, they'd be in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a serious and consequential shift. But not just that. It seems to me that this was a message to any reporter in America. You know, you mess with stories that are, quote, classified, and, you know, you're going to end up in jail. I mean, this had to have an insanely chilling effect right across the board.
So two major things last week that Sessions did that are totally not normal, and we've touched on both. One was his Department of Justice not defending the ACA, the pre-existing conditions, from a frivolous lawsuit, instead joining it. So that could impact 52 million Americans. But also going after, surveilling a New York Times reporter and her emails and her phone calls. And this seems to be Sessions trying to curry favor with Trump and to stay in place while they do these horrific things that are un-American and cruel at our southern border, separating children and parents. I mean, people migrating to this country are coming for a reason. They're not watching CNN on the way up to find out what our foreign policy is. They're coming here for asylum. And the stories that are just starting to come out of a Honduran man killing himself because he was separated from his wife and his son. Mothers in Seattle last week, the congresswoman there interviewing them. They were brought up to a detention center here because they don't have enough place to house these children and people. They were ripped apart from their children when they crossed our border. I mean, this is not America. And now we have this week, literally, he's putting extra troops or DHS's extra watch on our northern border because Canada is our enemy. Like, this is all happening at a super fast pace. A realignment, these things that are totally un-American.
Yeah.
We have to all beware. And the election this November is super important.
I think when you were last on my program, I had been, before you came on, reading from Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free, about the transition that happened in Germany. It's worth mentioning again. That book, I think, is the bookend to your book. And even though I'm not even sure it's still in print, but it's still available. And it's remarkable. We were talking earlier in the hour about, I was asking the question in my first hour, what did Trump get in exchange for giving away the ending of our military exercises, setting aside the debate about whether we should continue doing them or whatever, but, you know, it was a bargaining chip.
Right.
He spent that chip. And then also this gradual denuclearization being tied to gradual reductions of sanctions, which is completely the opposite of the United States position. But now China, Russia, and North Korea are all reporting that Trump gave that away too. Why?
Well, there's a couple of things to think about. One, all of a sudden last week, Trump twice spoke out about Putin and Russia being included in the G8. really odd. All of a sudden, Putin reappears 5 months before our midterms. It was almost as if he were like reawakened by Putin, just time to start to, speak again and get involved, which is part of this whole rural realignment and questions of what role Russia might have played in our election and what they have this compromising or what's the quid pro quo there.
Or how much money he owes Russian oligarchs and billionaires.
Right. And of course, the people are pointing to a Wall Street Journal interview where Putin had suggested giving up those South Korea exercises from January this year.
Right.
So,
and China has protested them year after year for over several decades now. And of course, North Korea, I mean, Kim killed, or maybe it was his father, killed 40 American sailors protesting the exercises.
It's almost as if we're splitting up the world into spheres, that we're going to have a sphere, the oligarchy.
It's like World War I all over again.
There's no common sense. I think for Trump, part of and a lot of what he does is stagecraft. He got exactly what he wanted from the media. He was made to look like a statesman. He was able to distract from all the other stories that he doesn't want covered. And what he's been able to effectively do is create a second version of reality that so many of his followers and people in between aren't really sure which truth they should be covering.
Yeah. It's a little bubble they live in.
Yes.
Amy Siskind, the former Wall Street executive, president, co-founder of The New Agenda, the book, The List, a week-by-week reckoning of Trump's first year. Amy, thank you so
much
for being with
us. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great meeting you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
With more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. In the world of work, one of the most important things is one of the things that people probably think the least about until they have to sit in it, which is their chair. And the X chair is absolutely extraordinary. This is the new high tech. In fact, they've got a brand new version. It's called the X3, the newest version of the X chair. It is comfortable. It is high tech. And yes, I'll say it. It is sexy. This chair is extraordinary. And it will dramatically, consequentially improve your concentration and productivity because it's going to help your posture. And, if you're not in pain and your blood is working, flowing well, your brain is going to work well. The new X3 is quite simply the most modern, ergonomic, high-tech, comfortable office chair in the world, period. The X3's unique ATR fabric makes it feel like you're literally floating on air. And its patented split-back lumbar technology provides a cradling, customized feel that has to be experienced to believe. You need to see and feel the X3 for yourself. Go to xchairtom.com. That's xchairtom.com now to check out the X3's perfect blend of design and ergonomics. There's a lot of people, checking these out and going for these chairs. Supplies are limited, so don't wait. Order at xchairtom.com. And if you do it now, you get $100 off. That's xchairtom.com. Or you can call them at 1-844-4-X-CHAIR. This chair comes with a 30-day, no-questions-asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. That's how good it is. Go to xchairtom.com. Right now, use the code TOM, T-H-O-M, to get a free footrest. xchairtom.com. Now back to the podcast. And welcome back. Oh, my goodness. Let's see here. Bob in Farnham, Virginia. Hey, Bob, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hello, my friend. How are you?
I am well. What's up?
Like many of today's callers, I believe this is all the money. I think that the summit in Singapore was like the advertisement mailer that comes to your home in the mailbox from the timeshare company, advertising what they have for you. Yeah, Trump has talked about Kim Jong-un visiting Washington. That's going to be his free weekend. As a wealthy employer once commented to me many years ago, he said, red, white, and blue, it's a lot of nonsense. He said, the only color that really matters is green. I really think it's all about the money.
But here's the thing. Kim is broke. I mean, he had to fly. China had to donate an airplane to take him to North Korea, and we had to pay for his hotel. He doesn't even have an airplane to fly to Washington, D.C. on. There's no North Korean airline. I mean, he's got, or if there is, they've got like, one plane or something. I mean, what money are we talking about here, Bob?
The money that's available for him when people start buying and investing in his company, he'll be treated like the little king that he is.
He being Trump or he being Kim?
Kim.
So you're saying that you think that Kim is going to go kind of Chinese version of communist capitalist, and he's going to start selling off his beachfront properties on the Pacific Ocean there, and Trump's going to build the hotels, and they're going to get rich together. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I don't think that Trump has the United States, our policies, our security, our country, and in his thoughts. I think it's all about money. I think the same thing is true of many of the leaders around the world. It's all about money more than their country. And I think he gains. We are funding him. And the way he gets his funding from the United States, this being Trump, is he rings Pavlov's bells of patriotism. You and I were both weaned on John Wayne movies. Everybody's waving the flags. We watched all the early morning TV shows, Iwo Jima. We saw all this stuff. We thump our chests and we go to stadiums and sing the national anthem, and he tweaks that. He's got the government following him in lockstep. With a huge budget, they're funding him. He'll get anything he wants. And I think that the casinos are a big part of the plan, and that's part of his love affair with Adelson. They're all making billions of dollars with in Malaysia and all these places with their casinos.
Yeah. Has Adelson helped Trump keep his hotel? And I know he lost his casino license in Vegas because he was so corrupt.
I don't know the particulars, and I don't think that anybody really ever will. This is so convoluted and so disgusting, this whole thing, what's happened. The United States was founded on wonderful ideals, and to see what's happened, it's all greed. I think that's the original sin. Yeah. I'm not a believing Christian, but I believe there was an original sin, and that makes us different from every other species on the planet, and it's greed for the simple sake of greed. Not for what we need. And that's why he's selling out our national lands, all of our resources.
I very much hope you're wrong, Bob, but I think that you may well be right. Thank you very much for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I am super pleased and honored, happy, excited to have in the studio with me Professor Richard Silberstein. He is the founder of NeuroInsight at the moment. He is Professor Emeritus of Neuroscience at the Brain Sciences Institute at Swinburne University in Australia, where he served as the founding director. He was previously the head of the Department of Physics at that university. He was the head of the Department of Physics at Swinburne from 85 to 89, Foundation Director of the Brain Science Institute at Swinburne, the Honorary Senior Principal Research Fellow at the Howard Florey Institute of Medical Physiology, serves on the Executive Board of the International Society for Brain Electromagnetic Topography and the Pan-Pacific Conference for Brain Topography, as well as the Editorial Board of Brain Topography. He has a longstanding interest in functional brain imaging. He is the inventor of something called steady-state topography, a technique for mapping rapid changes in human brain activity. Professor Silberstein, it is wonderful having you with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's been a while. You've been on our program before.
Once before.
From Australia, or was it when you were here?
No, I was visiting.
Great.
At the time.
Great. So you have been doing some just extraordinary research into attention deficit disorder and creativity. And to start at the beginning, what is creativity and what causes it?
There are different versions of creativity. The simplest one is the creation of essentially a new idea which is of some use. So I'm limiting it to ideas rather than, say, some forms of artistic creativity, such as dance, for example. They're all forms of creativity, but you've got to start somewhere. So we're starting with a new idea that is of use as essentially a creative process. Some people seem to be able to come up with new ideas very easily. Others less so, and there's been a lot of research trying to understand what is different about the brains of people who seem to be intrinsically creative, much as yourself, Tom, to those less so, and that's been some of my research, which has essentially flowed from the ADHD research.
So what is the creative process?
Well, that's fascinating. There's been some really interesting developments quite recently. Firstly, we now know that the creative process seems to involve two distinct processes. One, some means by which the brain seems to come up with new ideas, and these new ideas are invariably combinations of ideas that we already have. Much of this is unconscious. In fact, some of the creative process occurs in sleep when you're completely unaware of what you're doing, quite often relaxing, etc. But there's another part of the brain that decides whether that particular combination of ideas is good enough, whether it passes muster enough. And so essentially, these two processes, which we've known about for a little while, we've discovered the neural networks, the regions of the brain that seem to be responsible for this. And there's a part of the brain which basically seems to light up when you're not doing anything in particular. And this part of the brain, which is called the default mode network, seems to be the one that's involved in creativity.
So basically it's suppressed while you're thinking, while you're active, and when you just kind of lay back and let your mind go, this pops into action.
That's exactly it. When neuroscientists were doing studies understanding how the brain, how different parts of the brain light up, so to speak, when you give people different tasks, they were really surprised that whenever a part of the brain seemed to light up or regions lit up during a task, there would be this other part of the brain that would seem to be suppressed. And they didn't take much notice of it because they didn't quite know how to account for it. But when people were then relaxing...
Sort of like dark matter.
That's right. Or just relaxing, for example, in between tasks, this part of the brain really lit up and the task-related parts of the brain died, quietened down. So there's this yin-yang, push-pull relationship between the two. And that they first called this part the default mode because they thought it's the part of the brain that lights up when you're not doing anything in particular. But we now, it's anything but just a default or not doing anything particular. It lights up when you're just daydreaming, when you're thinking about yourself, others, relationships. It seems to be associated with empathy as well. And that seems to be the part of the brain that seems to be involved in coming up with these new ideas. As I said, most of those unconscious. But there's another part of the brain, which is in the left frontal cortex. That seems to be the judgment network. That seems to be the region which sort of says, I don't think that idea passes muster. So you can have a paradoxical situation that brain injury can make you more creative. And it does that because if the judgment network is damaged, it becomes less effective. Well, so it lets everything through then.
This is the story of Phineas Gage, isn't it?
To a degree.
He was the guy who back in the 1860s had a railroad spike go through his forehead and take out part of his brain that controls inhibition. And suddenly he'd been a God-fearing Christian. And suddenly he started drinking chasing prostitutes and swearing.
Getting into fights as well, which he'd never done before.
Right.
But there are some forms of brain injury and also dementias, which if they have frontotemporal dementias, if they affect this part of the brain, people for a while become much more creative. But unfortunately, generally, the quality of the creativity is not brilliant. So
because there's no regulatory mechanism
associated
with it.
That's exactly it.
So does this mean that if the average person spends more time or less time being hyper-focused on work or whatever's in front of them, even the book they're reading, and a little more time just kicking back, for lack of a better word, that they're actually going to be, they're going to engage that so-called default network and they're going to become more creative?
Yes. In fact, for some of the most important creative processes, quite often, I say, a scientist, you'll be thinking about a problem, thinking about different arrangements to solve that problem, getting nowhere. And you'll go for a walk. You might have a dream. And suddenly the idea comes, bang, fully formed. It's all solved.
I get my best stuff when I go on walks. In fact, when I'm writing and I'm stuck, the one thing that has, for 40 years that I've been writing books, the one thing that has consistently broken me out of writer's block or being stuck or whatever is going for a walk and not trying to think about what it is I'm
working on. That's the crucial.
Just going for the walk and enjoying it. And suddenly it pops into my brain fully formed and it's like, oh my God, that's it. And I got to write it down.
That's the default mode kicking in and the judgment network saying, hey, that's pretty good. I think I'll pass that into consciousness.
Right.
And you then wake up and say, my God, what a brilliant idea.
So how does this relate to attention deficit disorder?
Well, this is interesting.
To my club.
to your club. And really the point you made earlier about the link between ADHD and creativity in the 90s, the early 90s, was way ahead of anybody else. It's now becoming established. But that's also related to a rethink as to what causes ADHD. We used to think that, okay, it's underactivity of parts of the frontal lobes because of not enough dopamine, for example. So the various drugs, for example, would increase the amount of dopamine.
Right, this is what Ritalin does.
Exactly. And there are other related drugs as well. And sure enough, it seemed to influence the symptoms. But now we think that we've misunderstood the whole process, that in fact ADHD may not be so much too little neurotransmitter in a part of the brain, but a network, what they call a disorder, and I want to come back to this later. But basically what we think is happening is that when you're trying to focus on a particular task, if the default mode gets overactive and intrudes, it basically distracts you. So you start daydreaming, you start losing focus. And we think that ADHD now is essentially it's called a disorder where there is inadequate, if you will, control or suppression of the default mode when you're trying to do a task. Mm. And so now, of course, you can see where the link to creativity comes in. Because if, in fact, the default mode network is the region, is the network which is associated with the creation of new ideas, then essentially situations where, well, people who have an overactive or increasingly active default mode network can be, in fact, distracted. If that default mode network, for example, drives their motor cortex, which can happen, they become hyperactive. They become impulsive, for example. If it drives the visual cortex, they become visually distracted as well. So you can't have too much of a good thing. Hmm. If the default mode network is overactive and particularly drives parts of the brain that are associated with negative emotion, that can be associated with depression. Hmm. And in fact, there is a link between creativity and bipolar and depression as well. So
fascinating.
And that's related to the default mode network.
So we're going to hit a break in just a second. What do we do with this knowledge?
Well, we also understand two things, that there are methods by which you can maintain and control a balance. The issue is getting the balance between the task networks and the default mode network right, and being able to switch when you need to. And such methods as meditation are ideally suited to control. In fact, if you think about mindfulness meditation, what you're doing is you are watching the default mode network kick in now and then, and you're telling it to control. You note the intrusive thoughts, you don't judge them, you put them down to one side, and you focus on either your breathing or whatever, or the other things that are happening during the meditative process. But in addition to that, there are other methodologies which we can talk after the break.
Well, EEG neurofeedback.
Exactly.
I was talking with the inventor of the Muse device a couple of weeks ago. It's helped me tremendously. That's fascinating. We'll continue the conversation. I want to talk politics with you, if I may. As an Australian, as a keen observer of American politics, Richard and I have known each other for, decades, and one of my very, very closest friends, and I'm so glad he's here in the studio with us, Professor Richard Silverstein. He will be right back. It is 16 and a half minutes past the hour.
This Perfect. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with Dr. Richard Silverstein after this. Stick around. It's going to be fascinating. So, Richard, you and I were, as we were touring wine country yesterday afternoon, I was telling you, or maybe it was the day before that, I was telling you how when I started using the Muse EEG neurofeedback device, a technique that I learned when I first learned meditation back in the 70s, or the 60s actually, you sit there quietly and you repeat your mantra, or you count your breaths, you follow your breath, you say a mantra every time you breathe in or out, any of those, or you just sit there and be present. But anyhow, as an intrusive thought comes up, instead of letting it grab hold of you and drag you off into some long thought train where 3 minutes later you catch yourself and go, whoa, for the last three minutes I've been thinking about, that fight I had last week with my next door neighbor or whatever. Instead of that, you just kind of touch that thought, let it go, and go back to being present. And that's always been a struggle for me. I have been meditating. I've been practicing meditation for 50 years or longer. I'm 67. I learned it when I was 16, so 51 years. Not every day, certainly, and for many years, not even every week, but on a fairly regular basis. I was never able to easily accomplish that. And using this biofeedback device, the Muse contraption, it became easy for me to, it's becoming easy for me to do that. Does that mean that I am curing my ADHD, or does that mean that I'm just achieving a more balanced state? That, and does that mean that, that, you know, when I was growing up, had I grown up in another time, like the 19th century, when dysregulation was less respectable, and distractions were less frequent, that I probably wouldn't, I probably would have acquired that skill in childhood that I'm now acquiring in my 60s.
Yes, I mean, what you've also mentioned reminds me of a question that frequently comes up. If I control my ADHD symptoms, does that mean I become less creative, mm-hmm. for example? And the issue here is the balance, particularly the dynamic balance between this default mode and these task-related modes. What neurotherapy does, and it relies on the intrinsic plasticity of the brain, is enable you to set a new dynamic balance. The problem with drugs, for example, is they push you into one state hard on, for example, the task-related state, whereas what you really need to be able to do is to slip between these two states as you need. Now, sure, the default mode network, if it's overactive, can be associated with depression, but also it seems to be associated with empathy as well. And so it's been shown that people who are able to suppress their default mode network, really focus on tasks extraordinarily well, tend to have lower levels of empathy. And in fact, there's...
So like Hitler's bookkeepers who organized
everything
about the Jews.
Exactly. In fact, sociopathy. Now, there's an interesting point here. If you look at, for example, Tibetan Buddhist monks who've been meditating for decades, for example, they are able to, you know, control these networks amazing. Does that mean they are sociopathic? The answer is no, because in many of the meditation processes, one of the crucial things is compassion.
Yeah. And in fact, that's the Tibetan meditation. That's the focus. That's everything is compassion.
Exactly.
We'll be back with Professor Richard Silverstein right after this. Here you are. This hour brought to you by getquip.com/Tom. We're talking with Professor Richard Silverstein, Professor Emeritus of Neuroscience at the Brain Sciences Institute at Swinburne University, and the where he was the founding director and previously the head of the Department of Physics. A very smart man. And Richard, I wanted to talk politics with you,
if we may.
You've been checking in on this show for years and years, and we've been talking politics since we first met a couple of decades ago, in addition to brain science, our two favorite topics, I think. What is the we don't have a lot of time here. We have, I think, about 4 minutes. So in these, or 3.5 minutes, in fact, in these 3.5 minutes, I wanted to cover gun control in Australia, the rise of the right wing, is it happening in Australia also, and mandatory voting there. Pick wherever you'd like to start. I Americans would love to know what the state of politics is in Australia.
Well, very
important. And what do you guys think of Trump? Sorry. It's like dropping a bomb.
Just about all of my friends, both on the conservative side as well, considered it a joke when he first stood, and we're still waiting to wake up from the nightmare, to be frank. So each day horrifies us more than the preceding one. One of the things that Australia introduced, I think it was in the 40s actually, is mandatory voting. I mean, if you are a citizen, it is your responsibility to vote. It's as simple as that. Now, strictly speaking, your responsibility is to turn up to the voting booth and either fill in a slip and put it into a box. You can more or less write anything you want on the slip, so to speak, so in a sense you don't have to vote. But people take it seriously. You are fined, a very small fine, $50, if you don't vote. And I think it's been really important because...
You've got like 98% compliance.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Forgive the interruption.
That's right, yes. I think it's played a really important part because otherwise I think in many countries you have a situation where literally a minority of voters seems to determine the future of a particular nation. Brexit, for example, was determined by less than 30%, for example, of voters. So Australia seems to have taken, I think, a healthy route.
Mm-hmm.
As far as guns control, I am so pleased we don't have anything equivalent to the Second Amendment. Interestingly enough, it was a conservative prime minister, and strangely enough, in
John Major?
No, John Howard, in Australia. Mm-hmm. Our conservative party is
Britain.
Yeah. Our conservative party, confusingly, is called the Liberal Party, but it is conservative and increasingly so. There was a massacre in the late 90s, and John said, "Enough is enough." All automatic weapons basically have to be. There was a gun buyback
and semi-automatic,
and semi-automatic as well. That's right. There was resistance to it, but it was widely accepted that this is the right thing to do. And I think we've had very, very small number of massacres. I think there was one relatively recent one at a school, but we've been spared that.
Since 1998.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
What is the state of healthcare in Australia? I got sick visiting you in Australia once.
Yeah,
And I showed up at the doctor, and my recollection is that there was a $20 charge, and that was it.
That's it. Basically,
and that was because I was a foreigner, I think.
Yes, had you been an Australian. In some cases, there would have been no charge. There was a term known as bulk billing. In other words, whatever the government pays for each consultation would have covered the doctor's expense. In other cases, there's a small out-of-pocket expense. But basically, everyone is covered.
It's a single-payer system?
Yes, Medicare. But
so it's Medicare for all?
Yes, Medicare for all. Exactly.
And do you pay into it every month like we do with Medicare here?
No, there is a surcharge, a 1% or 2% surcharge on your income tax, and that's it.
Wow.
And that covers everything.
Wow.
I think it's highly effective. It was introduced by the Labor government, I think, in the late 80s, etc. The Conservative government have been trying to kill it, but I don't think they will.
Yeah, we have to wrap it up. Professor Richard Silberstein, thank you so much for
my pleasure.
It's great talking with you.
Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thank you. We'll be right back in just a moment. And welcome back. Bob in Rome, Ohio. Hey, Bob. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
It's amazing that all the hate we have for a guy that's trying to do so much good. I'm a conservative. Independent conservative. Why do you hate this guy so much?
Why do you think that the Trump's first legislative action of making it legal for coal mining companies to dump their waste into rivers that poisons people downstream is a good thing?
Look at the big picture.
No, Bob, you're asking a question. I'm asking you questions. Why is it that you think that, I mean, that's just a small micro of the giant macro of everything that Scott Pruitt is doing at the EPA.
What did he do this weekend?
Why do you think that this is a good thing, what this guy is doing to this country?
Why do you think
it's a good thing that the air is being poisoned more? Why do you think it's a good thing that the water is being poisoned more? I don't understand, Bob, how you think this is good. Please explain it to me.
Are you that big of a coward to answer my question first? Don't give me a question.
I honestly don't recall your question, Bob.
Why do you hate the guy so much?
I don't hate Donald Trump. I actually pray for Donald Trump, believe it or not.
And you know what? So did he do good or not good this weekend?
As I said at the, I don't know how long you've been watching the program. As I said at the opening of the program, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if what Trump did, which, by the way, reaching out to Kim and meeting with Kim, which, by the way, is what Barack Obama proposed doing in 2007 during the prime. Bob, let me finish my sentence, would you?
No,
he did not do it. Thank you for potting him down, Sean. What Barack Obama proposed in 2007 was a direct conversation with Kim, and he was savaged for it, principally by Sean Hannity. And I refer you to the Daily Show yesterday, or to, you can easily find it. Just, look around the internet. He was savaged for it. I agree with Obama, and I agree with Trump, that I think talking to your enemies is a good idea. Now, that said, Bob, and if it leads to peace in the region, or if it reduces tensions in the region, that's fine with me. I'm all in favor of it. But my question for you, Bob, is what do you think Donald Trump got for the United States in exchange for giving up the biggest bargaining card we had, which was our annual military exercises, which we've been holding in that region since 1954, giving that up, what did he get in exchange for that? And what did he get in exchange for telling Kim that with every small action Kim takes, we will give a small reduction in our sanctions when John Bolton, the national security advisor, says, no, you wait and you don't do anything until he has reduced his nuclear capacity to the point where he can't recover it. Your turn, Bob.
Can we say that, or is that what the pundits are saying? Because you know what? Everybody I listen to on all the stations, not Fox, I don't only listen to one, say they have no idea what happened there. But, you know, you and everybody else, you know what? You're making money. Great. God bless you. The American spirit.
So you're not going to answer my question, Bob. You apparently have no answer for that question. Thanks a lot, Bob. Good luck. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Stick around. And Stacia in Mount Vernon, New York. Am I saying your name right?
It's Stacia, Tom. Stacia. How are
I'm
you?
Sorry. I'm well. How are you?
Okay. I'm doing okay. I really enjoyed Dr. Silverstein. I work in the arts, so conversations about creativity and how it happens are always really interesting. In terms of the other question you asked before about Trump, he sold us down the river on that. And I really do believe that he gave himself away in talking about the beautiful beachfronts in North Korea.
Yep.
And that's what he's seeing. He's seeing an opportunity down the road for himself.
For his children.
And for his children, exactly. So we're really deep in the kleptocracy. And in terms of, you were talking also, another caller was talking about Obama and Trump and the ways in which Obama was held to a different standard. And it's just like, it doesn't matter what socioeconomic or education level you have in America as a black person, you are still going to be scrutinized differently than a white person.
Yes.
And so you can go to Harvard, you can be president, and any action that you take is going to be scrutinized. You're going to be held up for impeachment, whereas Trump can sit every day and commit treason and, you know, break the emoluments clause and just be a horrible human being and put families and children, I'm sorry, I'm getting really upset, into, you know, really horrible situations, tearing children away from their parents and not really looking for any solutions. Just like everybody's daily life is adversely affected. I mean, that man that was talking about his son, who's this bright kid who's just in a desperate situation and feeling really at a loss because of what's going on in this country. And I think so many people are feeling that. And it's just not fair. And it's, you know, no matter what, there is really no American dream. The American dream is just so unequal if depending on the color of your skin.
Yeah.
And even if you get to be president and even if you do all of the quote unquote right things, you are still going to be carrying a black card.
Well,
I don't know what you think about that, but
I think you described it very well, Stacia.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little hopeless about it. I don't know what the answer is. We all just have to get in it.
And, you know, change can happen really fast, Stacia, and we forget this at our peril. The most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. in 1998 was the tobacco lobby. They're wimps now. Most, you know, I don't know if it was a majority of Americans, but you could smoke in restaurants and on airplanes back then. Now nobody does. Gay marriage was considered such a pipe dream that when President Obama was running for election, he said, "No way, you know, I can't endorse that." And boom, now we've got gay marriage. Things change rapidly. There's always a backlash to the change, but it always ends up moving, you know, forward. The moral arc of the universe, you know, bends slowly toward justice. Absolutely. And so I'm not willing to slide into despair at all under any circumstances around this kind of stuff. Instead, I'm using it to energize myself, and I strongly recommend that you do the same. Stacia, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Oh, in fact, that's the end of the show. You're the last caller of the day. Stacia, thanks so much. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM on the program here. What a day. What an amazing day. I'm speaking at a conference tomorrow down in San Francisco on technology and media and things. And so tomorrow, Jefferson Smith is going to be sitting in this seat in the studio filling in for me. I'll be back on Friday. We'll have Congressman Mark Pocan with us on Friday. It'll be Anything Goes Friday. So, you know, have a great day tomorrow. Please treat Jefferson nicely. And as you always do, he's a great fill-in host, too. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us. All of us means you, too. So please find a way to get involved. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.